Welcome to Switzerland in Sound, produced and presented by Bob Zanotti.
And welcome to Switzerland in Sound. This is Bob Zanotti. Before we do anything else, a toast.
Santé.
Santé. I'm talking to Aubrey Diem, an old friend. Aubrey is a resident of Zinal, Z or Z-I-N-A-L, in the French-speaking portion of the canton or state of Valais in southwestern Switzerland. Not all that far from the Matterhorn, if we're talking about distances as the crow, the proverbial crow flies. Aubrey, you've lived here for many, many years. I believe it goes back to 1968 when you first discovered Zinal. I'd like to ask you about that in a moment. And it's in recent years that you have taken full residence permanently here in Zinal because you are a retired professor of geography from the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. But your story is much more checkered than that. It has even more to it. Let's go back to the beginning. You were born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. And then you emigrated to Canada, even became a Canadian citizen, a daring thing to do for an American back in 1960. What prompted you to do that?
Well, I had spent a year in Europe in the meantime, while I was still a student, and I saw things here that I liked. Of course, I know European history. It's a violent, bloody history. But the attitude toward life was much different than that with which I was familiar with.
And call it more laid back these days.
Yeah, more laid back. But one of the things that struck me most, perhaps, of Europe was the beauty here. In Detroit, there certainly wasn't much beauty. There was beauty in around Detroit, for example, at Cranbrook, which had sculptures by Carl Millis, a very famous Swedish sculptor, and the Detroit Institute of Arts, which was a very important place, and very few people know that it has the finest frescoes of the 20th century by Diego Rivera. But what drove me to Canada, because Detroit and Canada are very close, right over the border. There were two things. First of all, it's Canadian Broadcasting Company. Now, you're an old radio hand, so you know the importance of radio.
And very good, serious radio, high quality.
One of the best radios I've ever heard, and still, Swiss radio is very good, but the CBC was extremely special.
Okay, but you can listen to that across the border. You didn't have to go there to consume it.
But it was one of the reasons why I chose to go to Canada, because I thought, well, any country that puts out such great radio
gotta be a good place.
And so I had a chance to go as a professor to Waterloo, and the reason why I went to Waterloo is a professor who was teaching at Wayne University in Detroit, which was my university where I took my BA. He happened to go to Waterloo and he needed somebody else, and my profs recommended him very much as really a great guy and a nice guy to work with. So I chose and I took my whole family to Canada. Then there was also the Vietnam War. I wasn't personally affected, but my son was entering that period of time when he might be eligible
draftable
for the draft.
Age. Yep.
And I thought, this damn thing is going on nonstop, and who knows when it's going to end. And I said, it's better that we live in Canada. And the 40 years that I spent in Canada were really excellent years in which to raise a family. The violence, the attitudes, certainly they're not American. I mean, you just cross a river.
A more gentle, peaceful place.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you had no problems giving up your U.S. passport at that time. No. Today you could do it. You could keep it, but dual nationality. But at those days, you had to make a decision,
and you made a decision
in favor of Canada.
Yes, because I was working there. I wanted to take part in the society. I wasn't just a visitor.
You wanted to vote and so on.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's what I did. And 5 years later, I got my citizenship. It took 5 years at that time, and I got it right away.
What do you think of America and Canada of today? Many, many years later.
Well, maybe the best example is that Canada was against the Iraq War. The Americans started the Iraq War. We see what is happening. As a geographer, I more or less...
And historian, let's face
historian.
It.
I mean, I talked about this before the war even began. We talked together on the phone, and everything I told you more or less has come true. Other things that I never told you about, such as torturing prisoners and so on, has come true. So it's not a very interesting situation. The Pandora's box has been been opened, and it's never going to be fit back together. That doesn't mean that Saddam Hussein was a great guy. He wasn't. But there's a lot of men out there who are leaders who are despicable, and the Americans leave them alone.
It wasn't enough reason to start the war.
There's only one reason. They wanted to secure oil. It's the cheapest oil in the world to get out of the ground, and there's plenty of it. They wanted to secure it for stupid reasons, because they're building all these big cars, SUVs. They get 5 miles to the gallon, and it's the American way of life, and that's not my way of life, that's all.
A lot of Americans who may be listening to this, I can just hear them saying, this guy's anti-American.
Look, I'm American by birth. I had all my education in the United States. I graduated from Wayne University, Clark University in the East, University of Michigan, one of the best universities in the world. I have nothing against the America that was then. I have a lot against the America that is now. It's changed. There was only 135 million people there when I grew up. Now it's close to 300 million. It's become, in a sense, almost ungovernable. And it's not governed by democracy. It's governed by special interests, by lobbyists. They're the ones who are doing the whole show. The people are paying the price. But their democratic input is very limited. I didn't win Golden Palm, as Michael Moore did, for Fahrenheit 111. And he grew up in Flint, Michigan. My father died in Flint, Michigan.
Also Ridgewood, New Jersey, he lived, too. And yeah, I'm from the town next door to Ridgewood. You know?
But he's the only real opposition in the States that you can focus upon, because he says it like it is.
But he's doing it very well.
He's doing it well because he gives the people that he interviews enough rope, and they hang themselves. It's as simple as that.
We have to mention that you taught geography, but intimately related to that is history. And one thing leads to the other. You become a politician. You can't avoid it. It's all intimately connected, isn't it? I mean, it's all one big package.
Well, I think the best example are the things that I watch on German television, the reportages, and they're excellent, by people who know the Middle East from top to bottom. They've lived there.
They can openly talk
about it openly. And you compare that to CNN, everything's so superficial. And as a geographer, I know the Middle East strictly by maps, but the maps tell a lot. The borders are all artificial. They were formed by the British and the French in the First World War in 1916. You can't keep anybody from coming into Iraq or getting out of Iraq. It's a border that goes through the desert. You have a camel, a 4x4. You just get in with explosives, whatever. The knowledge of the cultural, of the historical background, allowing the museum in Baghdad to be plundered. Why, this is a museum for all of us. It's not just for the Iraqis. Western civilization began in a way there 5,000 years ago. And this place has been, for 5,000 years, a land of turmoil. And the Americans have this naive belief that Coca-Cola and Golden Arches will solve the problem in 3 months. It can't be done.
Anyone listening to you will conclude immediately in this age of political correctness that you ain't. But you have a philosophy about not being politically correct. In fact, you detest it and disdain it.
Well, you have to say the truth, and the truth hurts, and society has grown into what it is by sublimating the truth. And certain people like Bertolt Brecht, a very famous German author, and John Fowles, British author, you know, they call it the way it is. They said there's corruption out there, and it isn't just corruption of a few. It's total corruption. It's a corruption of a society. And I don't want to get off onto that, because that would take another hour to discuss in a nice way. But it's the corruption of the human being and the sublimation of the same human being of the reality, which allows him to survive with his uniforms, with his pageantry, with his television. But the reality of the situation is very bad. We live, all of us, 5%, the upper percentile of the whole earth, but millions and billions are living on a dollar a day. And yet we keep going on this way, and we keep wasting everything in armaments, destruction. But for things which are positive and constructive, we always have difficulty finding the money. But we never have difficulty in finding the money for bombs, whether they're smart or dumb bombs, or smart or dumb admirals or generals. So I think that's very important. We must find the money to educate people, not to brainwash them, but to educate them in a way where they can think for themselves. That's very, very important.
We hear a term, and it's used actually on both sides of the aisle, left and right, and that is the dumbing down of society. And of course, if you take an American perspective, it's the dumbing down of America specifically. What do you think of that?
Well, that's very important because the universities are certainly dumber, Canada included, and the Swiss universities. People have told me that. I've lectured in Swiss universities. There is a general dumbing down. People are afraid of the facts. We look at things such as imperialism and colonialism, which were rampant at the beginning of the 20th century, and we see the same thing happening today, but nobody knows about what happened at the beginning of the 20th century. You ask an Indian, you ask an African, even if you ask a Canadian native person, they'll tell you about colonialism and imperialism. It wasn't very nice, but we grew up thinking that this was the glorious Western society expanding.
West brought culture to the East.
Yes, exactly.
And the South.
And so this is very important. Everybody must know history, and history goes back a long time, not just a few years ago. The Americans seem to have forgotten about the Vietnam War, but in Spiegel magazine, which is like a Time magazine, although 10 times better, I mean, it's just incredible how well it's written and what's in it. They compared the Vietnam War with the Iraq War, and they were dead on in this cover article. And
this doesn't go over very well in Washington.
No, because the whole war has been based upon lies, untruths. That you get already in Europe, in the newspapers. One newspaper, the Swiss newspaper, Le Temps, it said there were 20 lies which brought the war into fruition. I've read a commentary in the Nouvel Observateur, a French magazine which came out in a special edition before the war, right after the war, and they go back and they describe how the war began. In 1998, Bush Sr. brought together Bush Jr., who was he was governor of Texas. He knew nothing about the Middle East. In fact, he knows very little about any place in the world except what he's fed by people around him. And too many of these people think they're intellects, but they have no intelligence. They're not well read. They don't speak the languages. How many know Arabic, can read Arabic? And anybody who is against this is unpatriotic. That's what I find terrible.
I'll throw my two cents worth, and reminds me disturbingly of Goebbels in pre-war Germany.
It's very similar. What goes on in the prisons, this torture which we see, it's no different than what went on in the concentration camps. It was humiliation of the prisoners by the guards, and the guards knew that there was nobody up there who was ever going to bring them to justice. They could do what they wanted to do, and you have a lot of sadistic people. In a professional army, you don't have exactly do-gooders. You have people who are trained to, quote, some American lieutenant or colonel, to kill. And that's it. And that's where the problem is. It's the war that's a problem, not how do you fight a war. Well, you fight a war to kill the enemy. The way in which you kill that enemy, to me, doesn't matter at all. What's a napalm or poison gas or a bullet through the brain? Is one clean, or we can say kosher, and the other is unkosher?
Aubrey, we have to change the tenor a little bit because I know you're very passionately concerned about this issue and this collection of related issues. But let's look at something a little bit more mild and genteel, travel. Although travel in terms of expanding the mind and increasing the intellect is certainly an important thing, but travel is a passion of yours and has been since childhood, I understand.
Well, I think I started traveling from Detroit to New York, where I had relatives with my mother, on overnight trains going from Detroit to New York. And I went to the World's Fair in 1939 with my father and my uncle and my mother in a little coupe, Pontiac coupe. And from then, it was just one after another. I started field tripping with the geography department of Wayne University. Then I spent a year in Europe. And during part of that time, I was teaching the U.S. Army geography in Leipheim, Germany, for the University of Maryland. And then the rest of the time, I was hitchhiking around. And I went to North Cape, the most northerly point in Europe, in Norway, and as far south as Rome. And later on, filled in Sicily. In fact, I did my doctoral dissertation in Sicily. So I've traveled and continue to travel, and that's the real education. And I took students many times to Europe because that was the area which I taught. We went for 6 weeks. It was a field course, and they got credit for it. It was not just going from bar or restaurant to restaurant. We met people who knew what they were talking talking about, whether they were agriculturists, city planners, industrialists, and we would have lectures. We were IBM, Daimler-Benz, and so on. And it was very successful. The students got a great deal out of this course, you could call it, in 6 weeks. So by travel, if you're open to it, if you know what you're looking at, you see more in a few weeks than you do in 2-3 years in the classroom.
Travel to Sicily. You mentioned you did your doctoral thesis in Sicily. Incidentally, what was the subject of that thesis?
Well, Sicily, what was interesting there was the agrarian reform. There was an agrarian reform and a land reclamation, and hundreds of million dollars were pumped into it. Dams were built, new villages were built, farmhouses were built, new techniques were introduced, and it was a complete disaster. And you say, how do I know? I traveled all over Sicily. I observed it. The water flowed into the sea from the reservoirs.
And some very rich people as well.
Yeah. Well, it made people rich.
They redirected it to their own homes.
It made people rich who built the dams and the irrigation canals. The farmers were stuck out in the middle of nowhere in little villages. And in Sicily, people live in villages where there was no stores, no medical help, no teachers, nothing. And when I went through this place, I saw abandoned villages, abandoned farmhouses. I photographed all of that. That was part of my thesis. And Antonioni, who was Italian film director at that time, made one of these abandoned villages one of his sets. Rich people coming from Rome in their yacht and offshore anchoring and then taking a trip up into the mountains to see these abandoned villages and build a story around that.
We almost have abandoned villages in Switzerland too, in Ticino, although the reason for that is entirely different. But I want to follow up on this, Aubrey. You did your master's thesis going back a few years before, I think it was 1954-55. You did Aosta, and it also resulted in a book in the end called First Rains of Autumn, which you rewrote or amended afterwards to include an appendix called Enrico's War. That's a fascinating story.
The reason why I wrote the book was because I had experiences in the Valle d'Aosta, which is a large valley in the northwest of Italy, which was French. Actually, it was French-speaking until the unification of Italy and then became part of Italy. It's on the watershed of rivers which flow into the Po Valley.
Just on the other side of the Great St. Bernard Pass. That's where it begins.
Exactly. And what I saw, there was a lot of partisan activity the last year of the war between 1945. It was the resistance. And they fought, not on the street. They fought in the high mountains. They destroyed villages. They killed hostages. The Nazis were as brutal there as they had were everywhere else, and the partisans fought against them, and actually in the end they gained control of the valley just before the war ended. And Enrico Löwenthal was one of the partisans, and the way I came across him, I wrote this book. It sold in Zermatt because it has a sort of...
It was fiction. I mean,
fiction,
technically fiction.
Complete fiction.
Based on your research.
It was a love story that took place in the Alps, and it was about an American flyer who was shot down and who was taken into the high mountains to escape the Germans. And he fell in love with a woman who was... in the mountain hotel in which he had to hide for the winter time. So I wrote this book, and somebody writes me a letter from the States, and they said, well, how did you know all this? And it was a Jewish-Italian family whose cousin was in one of the partisan units in Aosta, and his name was Enrico Löwenthal. It was a Jewish family, but they lived in Italy, and he was only 17, 18 when he joined the partisans. And then he became head of a group of partisans which controlled the whole great Grand San Bernard Pass. So, of course, I met him, and we talked about this, and then I read from this family's daughter his diary, and I couldn't believe how similar it was to the book that I wrote. And she translated into English. And I read it, and I edited it a little bit, and I just said, I've got to include this in the next edition of First Rains of Autumn, and I did.
Even being Jewish, he actually saved the lives by his own choice of German soldiers and officers.
I think that's the most interesting part of the whole story, which isn't in his diary because it happened right at the end. He was checking the Grand San Bernard, and a German column, complete with ammunition, guns, and vehicles, was making their way over the Grand San Bernard to escape and seek asylum in Switzerland. And he stopped him in the forest, and he could speak German, and he spoke in German. He said, "You give us your guns and all your equipment, and we'll let you go over tomorrow to Switzerland." And they'd take your guns anyway. So he talked to an officer there. The two of them discussed the matter, and the officer accepted the terms, but then he thought all night long that they were all going to be killed the next morning. He let them go, and when he let them go, he said, "And you tell all your buddies back in Germany that a Jewish partisan saved your life." And more interestingly, the officer and Enrico exchanged addresses. They went to see each other after the war, and not too recently, 4 or 5 years ago, he went to Munich, where the family lived, to see the officer's daughter who had just given birth to a baby. Mm-hmm. And if the futility of war is anything, that's what it shows. I mean, this incident.
I know from past meetings with you, Aubrey, that you feel rather passionately about Switzerland and this whole affair involving the Holocaust money. You think Switzerland got a bad deal there?
Well, it isn't that I think. I wrote recently after I retired a book called H's for Holocaust. And in that book, doing the research, I realized that the Americans and the English were very much to blame for what happened for this reason. In 1938, there was a conference at Evian, not far from here, on Lake Geneva. What to do with the Austrian Jews who had just fallen under the Nazi yoke when Hitler took over Austria, the Anschluss. And there was great talk. All the Western and South American and Asian democracies, so to speak, like Australia, New Zealand, and so on, were there. They did nothing. They talked. Then, worse, at Bermuda, there was a second conference in 1943, and by that time, at least 3 million Jews had already been gassed. And again, it was only talk, and not one thing was done. And Hitler knew all this. He knew it in 38. He knew it in 43. And he says, "If they're not going to do anything or take them, I can do with them what I want." And that's exactly what he did.
So Switzerland was so open and sensitive to the issue, that's why they get picked on. Is that basically it?
Well, nobody knows, except a book just came out by the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, in which the remnants of 30,000 Jews who were in Switzerland during the war, which, because Switzerland was a neutral country surrounded by Nazi or Nazi-occupied countries and was more or less helpless. There was nothing much they could do, but they allowed these people to stay in Switzerland during the war. And the book that I'm telling you about is the letters which they wrote in every language, from Australia to Canada to the United States, thanking the Swiss, and they all said the same thing. "You let us stay there. Our kids went to school there. We ate your food. Our men worked like all the men worked during the war. And the women stayed in hotels in which nobody was staying because there was no tourism then." So even Swiss don't know this story. And then there was a Swiss police officer in the east of St. Gallen. He allowed about 1,200 Jews into the country.
Gröninger.
Yeah, but of course there were Swiss who turned them back. And of course it was official policy for the Swiss to turn them back at the borders. But somehow 30,000 got into the country. And the other thing is that Switzerland would never hand over their Jews, who are Swiss, to the Nazis. So, of course, everybody did what they had to do to survive, but the Swiss don't deserve the rap that they're getting. And one of the reasons you pick on a little country of 6 million people, I think at that time it was 4 million people, surrounded by fascists and Nazis, is because you want to keep the heat off of yourself. And in my estimation, didn't want anybody to know how anti-Semitic foreign affairs was. The Americans didn't want to know how anti-Semitic the State Department was, and it's all documented. I mean, it's nothing new. I just read all of this from various sources, and I saw what was happening. And the English and the Americans knew exactly what was going on. And they even had aerial photos, like of Auschwitz and various other places. They did nothing to bomb these places. They bombed factories instead. The gas chambers remained functioning in many places until the end. And the worst example is the Hungarian Jews, 400,000 of them who were killed from about 44 to 45. It was a whole Hungarian community. And there is so much that could have been done because, as an addition to what I've just mentioned, there were 7, 8, 9 people from Japan, from Portugal, from Switzerland, including a Swiss diplomat in Hungary, and also a Swede, Wallinger. These men by themselves saved over 100,000 Jews, and they were not working in collaboration with their governments. So if these men could save 100,000 Jews, certainly the United States and England could have done a hell of a lot more than what they did.
Why did you decide to make Zinal, Switzerland your home, Aubrey?
Well, I really have always liked nature. I started in Detroit, spending summers on the lakes and summer camps, and I started skiing there as well, even though it's very flat. And I always liked skiing, and I liked nature. I did a lot of canoeing in Canada, and I was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan when I was there. It was very wild, and I always liked that kind of life, and I always wanted an outdoor life. And I'm not an office person. I worked in factories. I drove taxis. I decided long ago what I wanted to do, and when I had the chance, I did it, and that was to become a geography professor. I'm a basketball player in high school. But here you have nature as it should be. It is the real world opposed to the artificial world that human beings create and the tensions that go along with it. The animals are here. The glaciers are here. The avalanches come down. The rivers flow. It's let's say if there's an accident, somebody's dying here, it's a natural accident. It's an act of God, so to speak. That I can take. I can't take what's happening in Iraq today.
But it's not only Zinal. I know you also have a love for Switzerland as a country itself.
Well, interestingly, this is what very few people know. Switzerland is the only country of Europe that doesn't have a royal family. It's a very egalitarian country. And I like that a lot because I grew up in the United States. It also was at that time a very egalitarian country. And I like the way in which the French language, the Germanic language, the Italian language, and the Romance language can survive and actually help to survive. And I like the way the people mix together, the way they use the language. And I actually brought my children here in 68, 69, and they went to a little one-room schoolhouse, and they both learned French. They didn't like it at the beginning, but I said, tough, you're going to learn it. And my daughter today has an excellent job with Air Canada in Montreal. She could never have this job if she wasn't bilingual. And because I moved to Canada, I realized, maybe the Canadians didn't, but I realized how important it is to know more than one language. And if I'm correct, you speak Swiss German very, very well. I heard your French is excellent, and also English, and certainly Italian. But to me, language is a food of the brain. And it keeps you going all the time. And you learn about cultures, and it's part of you. You're not just a unilateral person. You're a multilateral person, depending upon the languages you know. I wish I knew more.
You can visit so many different cultures, but never even leave the country. It's the amazing thing.
Exactly. The architecture is different. The local histories are different. The religions are different. The languages are different. And the mentality of the people are different. Certainly the Swiss Germans are very different from the French-speaking Swiss and the Italian speaking.
It causes tension sometimes, but it also makes it all interesting.
Yeah, of course. Well, yeah, but it causes tension. But since 1848, there haven't been any major wars in Switzerland.
It's all relative.
Yes, it's relative. But to remain neutral in the First World War was a stroke of genius by the Swiss, because the First World War was just a war of colonialism and imperialism. These nations run by kings and czars and maybe parliamentarians, they had great...
Playing royal monopoly.
Yeah, royal monopoly. They had colonies. They had to show the Austrians, the Balkans was their area of colonization. The England was India and the Middle East during the war. The French, we know, they were in Africa, Indochina. That's what this war was all about. And the Germans supported the Austrians, who were supported by the Turks, and the British supported the French because of alliances, and the result was this disaster of the First World War. And maybe I should end on a very poignant note, very simple. I was in Gallipoli, where the terrible battle was fought between the English and the Turks. It was Turkish ground, and the idea was Winston Churchill's. He was Lord of the Admiralty, and it was a stupid idea. And they lost hundreds of thousands of men there by disease, by fighting. So I was visiting the graves not long ago, and the grave sites are always beautifully kept, you know, where they're fighting in misery. But once you die, we make it nice and garden-like. And there was a little inscription, "For God, for country, and for empire." And it was a boy's name, and he was 17 years of age. He had come from New Zealand, was killed in the Dardanelles. Well, I'm 72 now. I know what it's like to be given a chance.
And today the empire doesn't even exist anymore.
That's just it. It was all ephemeral.
Fighting for fleeting moments in history.
And that's what we're doing right now in Iraq. It's the same thing.
A few years, it'll all be forgotten.
It'll be forgotten, exactly. Somebody else will take over.
Professor Aubrey Diem, professor of geography, but he might as well be a professor of history, which is intimately related. Difficult to know which is his greater passion. A world traveler, photojournalist, prolific writer, and resident by choice of Zinal, Switzerland in the mountains, of French-speaking Switzerland in the canton of Valais. For Switzerland in Sound, on a beautiful, peaceful, sunny day in the Valaisan Alps, this is Bob Zanotti.
If you want more information about Switzerland in Sound, check them out online at www.switzerlandinsound.com.